Thursday.
Yeah.
So there are a couple of days more if you want to have the chance to interact with us. So Martin was a postdoc at the National Center for Quantum Information in Gdansk, and very, very recently, that means 1 week ago, he moved to Bristol University to join the Quantum Information Group in Bristol. Martin's interests are, of course, information causality and more generally non-locality and Bell inequalities and quantum information processing. So let's start.
Thanks. For me, it's a great pleasure to be here and in Canada in general. I like this country so far. And as Julia said, I will be talking about information causality. And here is a picture by M.C. Escher. It is called Curlaps. And it curlaps as these animals here. And what's written there is in Dutch. And it's a description, a study of these little lizards. The important thing about them is they don't exist, but it did not stop Escher from studying them. And there is also this wonderful short story by Stanislaw Lem. He was a Polish science fiction writer, called Probability Dragons. And it starts more or less like this. There is a university which studies dragons. And, of course, we all know that dragons do not exist, but everything that exists has already been studied and is more or less trivial. So only the things that don't exist are really worth looking at. So what I do is I study dragons, and what I'm going to tell you in this presentation is why I study them. What types of dragons do I study? Because, of course, you probably understand that I'm not talking about fantastic creatures. And what are my tools to study these creatures? And what these tools give me? So, why do we study dragons? The first, maybe not the first, but the most prominent dragon was actually a demon, Maxwell's demon. And okay, it's perimeter. I don't need to explain why foundations are important. But what I want to point is that the important thing about Maxwell demon is that it doesn't exist. And the study why it does not exist and giving reason to why it does not exist, what's so important about it? So the dragons that I am studying also, of course, do not exist, but the reasons why they don't exist is what's making the study of them important. So this is another painting by Escher, and he made a lot of paintings, drawings, which represent buildings which are impossible in our universe. Why is it impossible? Of course, we see the staircase and there's one line of people going constantly up, while the one line of people is going constantly down. It cannot happen. More formally, if we put numbers here, which denote the height of these 4 points, these 4 corners, we know that such a thing cannot hold. So if we can express it as a game. Alice and Bob, they want to pretend that they have such stairs, and I will be asking them question. I will ask Alice either what is the height of A0, and Bob, for example, what is the height of B1, and they win if they answer correctly such that this holds. And of course, since this is impossible, we know that that in such a game, the sum of these probabilities will never be 3, but at least one of them also must hold. So they also cannot lose every time in this game. So such a thing calls. And for those of you who know, this is a Zorn-Gill version of CGLMP Bell inequalities. It's a Bell inequality. But a very particular one. And now, if I write the same Bell inequality for the people going up and for going down, add them together, and do some just elementary operations, what I'm going to get, another elementary operations, is something which looks like this. And here I already made the assumption that A and B can be only 0 and 1. Now, why I do this? Because now what I have here is called CHSH inequality, which is the most famous Bell inequality and the one which was most thoroughly studied. So I can write it in this form, which means Alice and Bob get settings A and B. Settings, it's for physicists, for information theorists or computer scientists, these are questions. A, capital A and B are answers or measurement outcomes. And we know that in classical physics, such a sum of probabilities, of conditional probabilities, cannot be greater than 3/4. Now, what's really important is that in quantum mechanics, it can be greater than 3/4. So, in a sense, such stars do exist in quantum world. But they cannot be too steep because, one can easily find a theory which gives this value to be equal 1. And so the stars are really steep. But what is amazing that this theory is not true. It doesn't describe our universe. In our world, we never observe systems that can give you the probability of winning this game with certainty. So this is my dragon. This is what I'm hunting down. And everything which is below this number is just an ordinary creature. It happens everywhere in the world. Between this number and that number, there are quantum creatures like unicorns or manticores. They are little fantastic, but still peaceful. Above this are dragons, and we would like to show that though some fantastic creatures exist, dragons don't. Okay, so how can one do this? Well, of course, one can say, this picture. So this is Alice and Bob, and they are sharing this box, which is impossible in our universe. It's, again, Escher. He really had a lot of quantum pictures. So how do I do this? Of course, I can say, well, that boxes are impossible because I've got this density operators and whole Hilbert space and there are these measurements, POVMs and so on. And I do some algebra and I see that that boxes with greater success probability of winning this game are impossible. But the question is, why do I have this mathematics? Why can't I formulate quantum mechanics in a slightly different way? For example, there was a beautiful paper last year which showed that if quantum mechanics instead of complex numbers would be based on quaternions, you could have such boxes. So why don't they exist? Okay. One good approach is to use some operational criterions. For you say, okay, if I had this box, then I could do this information processing protocol, and if I can do this information protocol, something really bad happens. For example, maybe I could signal instantly from one place to another. But as we know from the paper by Popescu and Frolich, who introduced these boxes, and they first wondered why this game cannot be won with certainty, no signaling doesn't give you anything here. So then there was this idea by Van Damme and Cleve, who thought, okay, maybe if we had access to such boxes, every communication complexity problem would be trivial. So we have a really, really complicated function. I get some of the inputs, you get the rest of the inputs, you send me one bit, and I can solve the function. And Van Damme and Cleve, they independently shown that, yes, if we had such perfect boxes, it would be possible. But then, if our boxes were only a little noisy, so in other words, if the probability of winning that game would be 99.9%, this wouldn't work. This result has later been improved by Brassard and others, and what they have shown that as long as the probability of winning this game is greater than 90.6%, you can also make every communication complexity task trivial. But 90.6% is slightly bigger than this quantum value. So though they like sort of excluded the possibility of existence of like black and red dragons, some really, really tiny dragons still could exist. So this is where our idea comes, and it is called information causality. And after this introduction, I will present you this this principle and show you how can we derive this bound, quantum bound, on the probability of winning this game, called also Tsirilson bound. Called Tsirilson bound because Tsirilson was the first to derive this bound, though only in the quantum mechanical world, so with all this algebra stuff. So let me introduce random access codes. What are they? Well, they are protocols where Alice gets 2 bits. And she sends only 1 bit to Bob. It's everything classical now. Bob wants to guess either this one or that one. So these calls are really useful because if Alice and Bob have access to this box which wins their game with probability beta, then they can also have random access codes which allows Bob to guess any of these bits with probability beta. This is really easy to show, and I will do it in like 20 seconds. Well, a minute. So imagine that Alice inputs to her part of the box some of these 2 bits that she got. And then she sends a message to Bob, which is one of these bits plus the outcome, the answer of that box. So Bob, if he is interested in A0, will input to his part of the box 0. If he is interested in 1, he will input 1. Now, if he receives this message, he takes the output of his box and adds it to the message. Message is this, so I put it here. But I know that with this high probability, this thing holds, because this is what defines me the game. So with very high probability, I will have this equality. Now, since A is given by this, I have that, and you see that if B is 0, this is exactly A0, and if B is 1, then these two guys cancel, and I have A1. So, again, if I have this task, Alice and Bob can achieve this task with success probability equal to the probability of winning that game. Now, what's so interesting about this task? Imagine that Bob and Alice, they have PR box, which is this perfect box, which wins this game always. So Alice takes two classical bits, she encodes them in one classical bit, sends them to Bob. Bob, of course, he gets only one classical bit. But somehow he can choose which one. So just before Bob inputs his setting to this box to get one bit, this box somehow knows both bits. And there is something really clearly wrong with it. If you can think about it this way. So Alice has a book, or many books. Each book contains many pages. And she just rips a couple of pages from each book, puts it in the channel, sends it, and the channel has capacity of one whole book. And now Bob gets these pages of the book, and then he chooses, okay, I want them to be pages from that one particular book. So it's like if Bob is the one who is choosing what the Alice has encoded, because he gets only one bit, but he can choose which bit was it. It's wrong. You cannot do this. So let me show you more formally why this should not hold. Okay, so there are these n random variables, and they are independent of B. What is B? B is the total knowledge about the universe that Bob has. So if Alice gets her bits, which she wants to transmit to Bob, this simple assumption tells me only that, that Bob doesn't know them in advance. This is like technical thing which we require. Now, Alice encodes these bits into the message X, which has M bits. And now, when Bob gets this message, he takes his all knowledge of the universe, and with this message, he processes it in such a way as to get as much information about one of these variables. He's interested in only one, denoted by I. So BI is a random variable which represents Bob's knowledge about if random variable of Alice when he uses the optimal protocol to get knowledge about that variable. And what information causality says is that the sum of this knowledge cannot be greater than amounts of bits sent. So what I was saying pretty vaguely when I was talking about pages and books and stuff is written in is written formally here. So this is the amount of information transmitted, and the sum of information that can be potentially obtained about all of these variables cannot be greater than this.
What is B capital BI sub I
represent? This one?
The capital B, yes.
The capital BI is a random variable which Bob obtains from his protocol when he wants to know what is the value of AI. So it can be...
It's like his best guess.
Exactly, it's his best guess.
And he cares about only one of the A's, or he cares about all of them?
he cares only about one of them. So if he cared about all of them, I would have like be here, because every time he would like to get all the information, and one can argue that it would be nothing else than no signaling. But since it's like optimized here over, it's optimized here separately for each eye, then it's slightly different than no signaling, and this is, and this difference actually allows us to get the serial sum bond. But
they're supposed to share some resources, is that right?
Yes. Well, I'm not. I allow them to have any resources. What I want to show now is that if they have a certain class of resources, then this thing will be violated. And what I wanted to do first is that I want to convince all of you that. This is a really reasonable assumption, and if some resources allow you to violate this inequality, then these resources are bad, and we don't want them.
Can I understand this as saying that if Bob was cloned or had a whole bunch of twin brothers, that the most information the whole group could get was him? Is that a way of understanding this?
Yes. Yes, exactly. That's true. So now, this is again the same thing, and this is more intuitively again what this principle says. It says that it is the sender, not the receiver, who decides what the message is about. So Alice can take her bits and encode her long string of bits, encode them into one or two. A very short message sent to Bob, and it is she who decides how much information can Bob get about each one of these bits. Bob cannot somehow backwards in time force Alice to do different encoding. This is forbidden, and this is formally what it says. Okay, so I have some more comments on why this is. Yes, this is Shannon's mutual information.
Yeah, but can you define it anymore? Just
Like an explicit. Yeah, like explicit definition, of course. Mutual information that A has about B is. Or B has about A is like entropy of A minus the entropy of A when we already know B. So, yes, it has the meaning of the knowledge that B carries about A. And it's symmetric, so it's actually the same what A knows about B. Okay, now. More comments on reasonability. So I'm really selling this principle here, and I would like to convince you that it's a reasonable thing to assume. So, as I mentioned, Bob, at the beginning, knows nothing before the transmission is done, knows nothing about the bits of Alice. This is the string of bits of Alice. So when he gets message, he should not know more than the size of the message. Now, we also assume that these bits are independently distributed, which means that if this is the knowledge he has about the whole string of bits, then his knowledge about some of the knowledges about different parts of the string cannot be greater. So, for example, Bob can know the sum of these bits. In this case, he will know almost nothing about any particular bits. So in this case, this inequality will be sharp. And on the other hand, for example, Bob can know just one single bit, then we will have equality. Okay, so we got this. And finally, because BI is obtained by local processing of these two guys, then data processing inequality, which is also really reasonable things to assume, tells us that local processing cannot increase the information that Bob has about this guy. So from this through there, we get what we wanted to have. Okay, so I've been talking a lot about this principle. Now, let me show you what can be done with it. Yes?
Can I ask a question? I haven't quite understood why the intuition that you're appealing to say that information causality is reasonable wouldn't also apply for some other measure of information. So, for example, if I looked at the sum of the probability of guessing each bit correctly, it seems to me that your arguments might also hold for that.
Yes.
But we know that that notion of information causality, that measure, doesn't hold true.
Yes, that's true. So, but then, so there are many reasonable things, and our task is to find one of them which is best for a certain application. So, if I like, I have a lot of cars, and if I go racing, I take this one, and if I go to pick my kids from the school, I take that one. And for this particular task, out of many reasonable things that we know, this one is the best.
It's really because here you are looking to the sum, and I mean, this specific measure is additive for independent, if your driver was very independent. I mean, maybe that's the reason.
So there's a step in this particular argument on this slide which would fail if I looked at the sum of the probabilities and guessed it correctly. Is that true?
I don't know.
Not necessarily, but I think what would be going on then is that condition though valid, it goes down here, it's not so restricted on the probability distributions. So all of these steps, in other words, one could motivate that this should hold for it.
So it might be that my figure of merit, you know, this particular argument in the poll. But I guess I wasn't satisfied by your answer that you use different figures of merit for different purposes. Mm-hmm. Because it seems to me you're trying to say information causality is reasonable, and here are the intuitions why. But if those intuitions can hold for any figure of merit, then it seems to me you haven't really justified that principle.
Okay, so let me justify it in a different way. Information causality is about transferring information from one party to another. And it goes through a channel. What is this mutual information is exactly Shannon's formula for the capacity of the channel. So let me write this down. We can also understand it that there is a capacity of the channel, and mutual information is sort of a sum. This thing is a sort of a sum of, well, imagine that Alice has this channel to Bob and she wants to cram like 20 different messages with the one use of the channel. So we can think in this case about capacity, sum of capacities of this single channel for each of these messages. Something like this, sum over these guys. And what information causality says is that this has to be bigger than that. And now, mutual information is really connected with capacity of the channel, while probabilities are not. Maybe this is better justification. I have plenty more, but none of them is perfect.
Well, you see, there are lots of arguments why
Shannon's formulation of entropy is the right one. I mean, there's also Renyi entropy and other mm-hmm. entropies and so on. But Shannon entropy can be singled out by certain axioms. Like when you have several channels, you need to have additivity and sub-additivity and things like that.
But Shannon comes in the syntopic sense, right? For finite cases, the other entropies may be even operational.
Well, but what I'm saying is you could supplement so your argument by arguments that lead to Shannon entropy, mm-hmm. right? And then it would be unique. But you don't have to, perhaps. Maybe there are other ways of doing it, but you could perhaps just instead of talking of one channel, you could talk of many channels.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I'm sure this is far from being reasonable, what I'm going to say now, but when I first started working on it, it seems to me so obvious that I have to use Shannon's entropy that, well, why?
Can I ask a different question? What's the difference between B and B sub I?
So, B is a pretty vague thing at the beginning. It represents whole knowledge of Bob about the universe before the protocol starts. So it's the knowledge about how the protocols works and whatever he has in his lab. And then after X is given to him by Alice, he, by local processing, gets this thing. So imagine a case that I...
So B is the knowledge about Alice's bits before anything happens.
Yes, which is zero.
Nothing.
Yes, this is what I say here.
All right. So the XB is his knowledge after she sends the message.
Yes.
And so BI is what he would, the guess he would make about the I bit.
Exactly. So, yes?
Can I ask you a probably stupid question?
Well, of course. the answer will be probably stupid.
I think I'm confused about the first line mm-hmm. of this intuition.
Uh-huh.
Because it seems, there is a protocol called information locking,
mm-hmm.
which
yes.
seems to contradict.
Well, yes, intuition. It's not a stupid question, definitely. So, the thing is that this is Shannon's mutual information, and it's not the information that appears in the locking. So at the end, in the locking, you will have this classical information, something like this. And of course, it the only similarity is that there is I here, but it's totally different thing. So for that, well, this formula holds for Shannon entropy, for Shannon mutual information. It doesn't hold for this classical information that is in locking. Yes, accessible. Yeah. Okay. So now, enough of motivation. Let me give you the result, because the result is what's really important. Yes?
Experimental setup, Bob has to choose which one he wants.
Yes. So,
which one he wants to guess about. But if you had a whole group of them.
He can simultaneously guess.
Oh, but if you had a whole group, each could guess about a different thing.
So, let's go back here. This is what Bob would do in quantum case. If he's interested, they share a singlet state, they will, they want, they have this experimental setup for a violation of CHSH inequality, and if Bob wants to know A0, he chooses one of the settings of his apparatus, and if he wants to know A1, he chooses the other setting of his apparatus. So, yes, these are totally exclusive things. Okay, now, so the question we ask is, let me go back again here. So, now, so if Bob can guess both these bits with certainty, of course not both at once, then he has the two terms in this expression will be 1 and 1, and 1 plus 1, k cannot be greater than 1, which is number of bits sent. So we see that PR boxes violate information causality. The question is, how much noise can we add to these boxes to make them not violated? And because the less probability of guess, the lower these values are going to be. So we are asking how much noise we have to add here. So this is not greater than 1. And the answer is here. It's something like 0.89. So this was a nice result that I got at the beginning of working on this. I was really happy because it was better than 0.906, which they got with communication complexity, but it was not Cyrilson bound. So what could we do to improve it? We can use concatenation. What does this mean? Imagine that this box, this is part of Alice's box, which is connected with this box. So this is one singlet state, then this is another singlet state in quantum case, or PR box or whatever, and this is a third one. Using the protocol that I have mentioned, Alice can encode these two bits into one message, these two bits in a second message, and these two messages, using third box, into one message, send it to Bob, and if Bob is interested, for example, in A4, he will first use this box to decode this message, and then put it here and decode that thing. And the great thing is that if you now calculate how noisy each of these boxes has to be in order not to violate information causality, you get something in the middle. And if you repeat concatenation many, many times, actually infinitely many times, you are going to get this Cyrilson bound, which made us all very happy. And this is like the main thing that information causality is useful for. I could stop here, but no. We did a lot of more work on this, and here is what I want to show you. So, maybe I will skip it because I was already... Oh no, I won't skip it. So, I put a lot of effort into convincing you that this is a reasonable principle. But some of you may not still believe me. So, for example, somebody may say, okay, but for example, locality is really really reasonable principle, and we know that quantum mechanics violates it. So maybe quantum mechanics also violates information causality. So we have shown that it does not. We have shown that the information causality can be derived from four principles, which are satisfied by quantum mechanics. So therefore, quantum mechanics cannot violate it. This gives us also another nice result, because it says that if you don't want to believe in information causality, you can say, okay, but I believe that in my theory, I can introduce some sort of mutual information, which is reasonable. It has these four principles. One is no signaling, which means that it doesn't mean that Alice cannot signal faster than light to Bob, but it means that this is what normally no signaling means, but here I need a weaker thing. I only want to say that if Alice sends no messages to Bob, then Bob knows nothing about her state. So what I'm saying here is that Bob is not omnipotent. Bob doesn't know every bit in universe, and we may consider bits after about which he has no knowledge. Second thing is also quite sensible. If B is C is obtained from B via local processing, it cannot increase its information about some other bit.
What's the relation between B and C?
So,
like, I see an inequality, but it doesn't tell me anything until I know something about B.
C is obtained from B by local processing, and A is somewhere else. So if I send you a message, and then you like encode it, rip it apart, burn it, it will give you nothing more than the message had at the beginning. Now, also, if A is a classical object, like a classical message, then what we really need to have is, it's not even this. We want to know that this thing is not infinite for classical objects. And finally, the chain rule. The chain rule is by far most tricky one. What I want to say about it is that though this is the form of the chain rule that we say in our paper that we use, what we actually do is we use this thing, which is weaker than that. From the upper thing, we can derive the lower thing. And this has the nice property that one does not have to introduce this conditional mutual information. So if you don't want to believe that information causality is sensible, but you believe these things, then you can derive it.
What is the meaning of...
Yes?
That last thing, I of C colon A
This one? This is information about C that is had by A and B together.
So this comma just means A and B together?
Yes. Yes?
So the first statement, one can take as the definition of the conditional mutual information, and so it would have no content at all.
Yes. So if I don't want to have this problem, because I can go two ways. I can say it's a definition of conditional information, and as you said, it has no content at all, or I say there is another definition of conditional information, blah, 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 and blah, blah, blah. But I can do something else. I can say, forget about this. I'm using only this lower guy. There is no conditional mutual information and so on. This is why I don't want to define another thing. Well, and... what can you say also is that this is the definition of conditional information, and if you add also that conditional information is symmetric regarding A and C, then you get this thing, and this is enough. Okay, so now, this is where the thing becomes interesting. Of course, finding Cyrilson bound was interesting at the time, but when we did it, it's like a result. Now, what more can we do? Okay. There is this space. It has four dimensions. Each dimension is the value of one of these four probabilities, and there is a volume in this space which defines family of probabilities which are possible in quantum mechanics. As I already told you, this sum cannot be greater than Cyrilson bound, which in this units here, this is from another paper, so units are a little different, is here. This is Tsigalesson band. But what is interesting is if Tsigalesson bound is not violated, it doesn't mean that the set of probabilities is quantum. No. This is like another direction in this four-dimensional space. I don't want to go into details what it is. It just somehow measures how different each of these probabilities is from one another. And this is quantum mechanics. And this is Tsigalesson band. So it would be really nice if we could get from information causality not only the Tsigalesson bound, by the whole boundary of quantum mechanical probability distributions. And so far we cannot do this. With the protocol that I have just presented to you, we get in some slices of this space, we really get exactly the same as quantum mechanics, but in some we get nothing better than Tsigalesson bound. So one might think, okay, so information causality does not work. But the trick is that information causality is that formula. There is a sum of mutual informations and so on. And then we use this concatenated protocol to prove this. But maybe there exists a better protocol which could give you quantum mechanics. And so I thought, okay, I'll find another protocol, and like a couple of months, nothing. So I thought, okay, now it's time to prove that there is no better protocol. And I almost had my proof finished when somebody found a better protocol. So this protocol goes like this. It's in a paper by John Alcock and Nicola Brunner and other guys from Bristol. So it's about non-locality distillation. You take two boxes and wire them to make a new box. So how does this work? If we, for example, have two peer boxes or two singlet states or something, and I get inputs, I put these inputs into one box. Alice puts her input, I put mine. We both get outputs, and then into the second box we put function of the initial input and the output of that box. Then we get something else, and the total output of our new box is function of output of this box, output of that box, and why. And it looks really like it shouldn't work, but it does. And so for two different protocols, it is like a vector space in it's like a, this drawing shows how these protocols behave in that space. So if I have a box here, after using blue protocol from two boxes, I will go up there. And if I use green protocol and I have a box here, after using this protocol, I will get box somewhere here. So this doesn't help a lot, but a little. So Ufink is the name of the guy who wrote an inequality, which is exactly what information causality with that protocol which I previously shown gives you. And if you use the one of these two protocols, the green one, you can, with one use, with a single use of this protocol, first distill boxes here, and then use our protocol for information causality to prove that they violated. But you can you use this distillation protocol twice and get the green ones, and three times and get these red ones. Still, there is a whole lot of space here. between NPA, which is another word for quantum mechanics in this space, and information causality, which is here. But at least we know that more complicated protocol can help, and we're not losing faith that maybe quantum mechanics can be derived from information causality, but I'm not a fanatic. I would be also really happy to find the proof that from information causality you cannot derive quantum mechanics, and we had some good ideas how to do this, but they also failed, so they were not that good at all. So, yes? Yeah, bipartite with two inputs and two outputs per the party. Yes, so this is really simple, but I have a slide about it. It says more complicated boxes. So what happens with more complicated boxes? One thing, if Alice has, if Bob has n inputs to his box, Alice has 2 to the power n inputs in her box, and they both have binary outcomes. You can consider such boxes. You can prove that as the simplest PR box is like a box which takes 2 bits and then encodes them into 1. These more complicated boxes are random access codes which take n bits and then encode them into 1. And for every box of this family, you can use information causality to give you exactly Tyrrellson bound. So this is, and this is what we have. Multipartite boxes. If there are tripartite boxes, information causality gives you something. It's not really good, but at least it's not trivial. So what I wanted to do is I wanted to get something like monogamy of non-local correlations from information causality, and it's like slightly better than what we get from no signaling, but not much. So, but I'm still trying. And 2 inputs and more outputs. This is really cool. There was recently a paper by Valerio Scarani, Alejo Sales, and Daniel Cavalcanti, and they have studied a case where each party has 2 inputs to the box, but box has any number of outputs, and what they have shown that information causality gives you pretty good bounds. It gives you better bounds than any other, I don't know if you know what Q1 is. Q1 is, or in other words, macroscopic locality. This is like the first approximation of quantum set. So I mean, I can talk about it if you want, but it's long, long story. So what they have shown is that information causality for these boxes gives you better predictions than any other operational defined principle. The cool thing is that they don't know if it gives Tyrrellson bound, because Tyrrellson bound is that hard to calculate. So this is another good thing for information causality. For these boxes, it is easier to use it to get bounds on quantum probabilities than using the whole quantum mechanics, because it's simply too hard. And so, yes, this is cool. This is like sort of generalized Tyrrellson bound for every Bell inequality. We have maximal quantum value, and this is what I call Tyrrellson bound. Mm-hmm. And we can do other stuff with information causality. For example, there is this paper by Stefanie Wenner and Jonathan Oppenheim where they show that from random access codes, from uncertainty relations and the property of steering, one can get bounds on random access codes and the other way around. And since information causality implies random access codes, then information causality plus steerings implies uncertainty relations. But it is, well, this is the intuition. It's not so straightforward. And what we are trying to do is to find what kind of uncertainty relations can be obtained from information causality. Also, applications in crypto. We know that no signaling can be really useful in device-independent quantum cryptography. And since information causality is sort of like no signaling but slightly more restrictive, we're hoping to get some applications in crypto of it. And information causality and the size of the universe. Sadly, information causality says nothing about the size universe, but the size universe says something about information causality. Namely, when I showed this concatenated protocol, each level of concatenation requires exponentially many boxes. So if our universe has only like 2 to the power, say 200 particles, then I can have only 200 levels of concatenation, which means that I don't get zeros unbound, but something slightly larger. And therefore, one can say that in finite universe, information causality doesn't give you zeros unbound. But let's forget about it. That's all. Thank you very much. Yes.
Why on earth do you call it information causality? Shouldn't it be called information locality? Because the whole point doesn't seem to be causality. The whole point seems to be that Bob cannot choose, because he's elsewhere, what Al is saying.
Yes, but then you can think about it like this. I have a theory which violates it. For example, this PR box. So Alice takes 2 bits. They are somehow encoded magically in the box. One bit is sent, and Bob can choose which one was sent. So after Bob receives the message, he can somehow backwards in time, violating causality, make Alice's box to do this encoding which he wants it to be done. This is the reasoning for this name. Actually,
it's an actual violation of causality.
Well, only if you assume that this is what really is happening there. But you can think of other processes that could lead to...
It seems a little weaker than actually violating causality.
It's an actual violation of information causality.
Yes. Actually, there were 6 authors of this paper. We voted. I was for generalized no signaling. I got outvoted.
but the reasoning is, so if the causality is violated, this is violated. So.
No. Could you repeat the question?
So, your explanation of this name is, one way to think of the violation of information causality is the violation of causality.
Yes, exactly.
So, this is just one way of explaining it. So, there may be another way to violate information causality.
Yes.
It may lead to another name,
Yes. It might be, for example, violation. Or it might be just signaling, simply like the box is that Alice's box is sending some information to Bob's box, but the box does just holds it really quietly until some information arrives, and then I had this information already, but it was hidden.
The premise is that Bob and Alice are separate.
Yes.
To begin with.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the non-locality.
I think it's about the fallacy of the information, that the box cannot hold something available for picking by Bob.
Well, I think somebody also had this idea to call it information locality, but at that time it seemed a good name. I mean, it's just a name.
It could be.
critically, Asimov are time-like separated in your scenario, not space-like separated, because they have to communicate. So it's not like Bell inequality setup.
Yes, but at least with boxes and quantum resources, Bob can make his measurements before receiving the message, and then only after receiving the message, just XOR it with his thing. But yeah, but the thing is that I don't want really like space-like separation. I just want them to be information theoretically separated. There is no knowledge at the beginning from about the bits of Alice present at Bob's lab. Yes?
There's one point that's not really clear to me, but it's not that in quantum channels you can implement VR boxes, right? So in what sense are you ruling out these kind of channels from quantum mechanics?
Well, what do you mean implement PR boxes?
There are fiber-type channels by which you can, by a suitable input and then a suitable measurement, have the correlations that define PR.
Yes, but there is also communication.
But you have just a fiber-type channel. So, my question is, are you just thinking that the quantum resources you are using are correlated states or any possible quantum mechanical
states? Well, I'm assuming they are quantum mechanical states. Well, because if I get it correctly, you are saying that I'm losing this job out here. That there is this channel, and Alice puts something here, she gets it back, and Bob puts something here, and he gets it back, yes? And, well, then, this...
The channel is not seeming, so...
Yes, well... So, okay, let's make it simple. I'm talking only about states, okay? So... The whole problem is that I have this set of probabilities which emerge from measurements of quantum states, and I want to bound it. It might be really interesting to think about channels, but I'm not going to do this now because I mean, it will take me days. Yes?
Can you talk a little bit about the wanted to use this as part of a full characterization of quantum theory. Some number of axioms.
Mm-hmm.
Then, so I think there's two things I would like to understand. So first of all, there are properties of quantum theory that apply locally, which this wouldn't seem to give you any handle on. So perhaps you need something else for that.
Yes. So this is also a problem that I see.
Okay.
But then the local thing is, for example, uncertainty relations. And there is a hope that adding another property like steering can let me get some local things. So I'm hoping that in conjunction with other things which I can, which might be reasonable, I can get local stuff. Also, if I want to think about local properties, I have another approach, which will probably not work, but there is a hope at least. So if there are properties, if locally states of Alice and Bob are not fully mixed, then it means that I can use them to store some information. And for example, one might think of a protocol where Alice encodes some information in her system, sends classical information to Bob, Bob gets some information, and then Alice sends rest of her system, which contains a little more information, and then considering such a whole protocol, I maybe can get bounds on information stored in this remaining Alice system, and it may tell me something or it may not. I don't know.
Then the second difficulty is more just sort of mathematical. It seems so that the constraints on the probabilities that appear in quantum states are polynomial.
Yes.
So the Bloch sphere is some squares, and I think Christoph talks about you get this also this cubic constraints.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the information causality principle contains logarithms. So you're trying to sort of get
yes, but then 1 minus h of 1 half 1 plus p is for small p's almost equal p square time divided by 2 logarithms of 2. So this is h, this is Shannon's binary entropy, so this is more or less the probability of guess. So if I, this is what we do with concatenation, we concatenate so much that this becomes more or less polynomial. This is how we get squares. So this is the hope to get polynomials. Just do it so many times that this looks like polynomial.
Which kind of confirms Lucien's remark that it's a rather unnatural way. So if you have to start with an extremely non-polynomial function and then take a limiting case so that it turns back into a polynomial, it just doesn't look like the most straightforward.
Yes, but we have this similar thing in Shannon's theory where mutual information is capacity of the channel only when you use it infinitely many times. So in information theory, it's sort of maybe not really natural, but more natural. In information theory, we often take asymptotic limit. Yeah. Also, there is another hope to not use Shannon's mutual information, but maybe other measures of information. This introduces a lot of problems, but if I take Reni entropy or Zalis entropy with squares there, maybe I can go without this concatenation and get something. I don't know.
Remembering wrong, but I thought that the actual inequalities that carve out the quantum region in this situation cannot be given by a finite number of polynomials.
Quantum mechanics is polynomial when it comes to this Bloch sphere, but this is single system. For these correlations, to satisfy quantum mechanics, it is necessary and sufficient to have sum over of r cosine of 2 times p. These are these probabilities, a plus b equals AB given AB, and this is sum over AB, and minus 1 to be correct, and this has to be smaller or equal pi. So that's a little complicated, but if you get some slices, it becomes polynomial, and this is how it looks like. So, but the... this is like it's in 4 dimensions. There are 4 of these probabilities. But if you take a slice of it, then it is polynomial.
But there's an infinite number of slices.
Yes, of course.
So you wouldn't be able to just get that with a finite number of polynomials.
Yes.
A more accurate way to put it, what Lucien and I were talking about, is that you can characterize extreme points by a finite number of polynomials. And then you have to supplement that with taking the convex hull of the extreme points. And now if you try to describe this, the boundary of the convex set, you wouldn't be able to derive that. You wouldn't be able to express that as a finite number of polynomial inequalities. So it's finite number of polynomials plus convex hull.
But another problem of information causality with this is, okay, information causality is not polynomial, this is not polynomial, but information causality is logarithms, and this is not logarithms. So it's... Yes?
Potential is to consider, how is it to consider this four-dimensional space? Because for me, as a computer scientist, it looks, you're looking at just XOR games. So you're looking at the probability of A XOR B is something. There are actually 16 probabilities. Given questions small A and B, there are 4 probabilities of getting each pair of large A and large B. So 0001, 0001. So it's really about not 16 dimensional because there are multiple constraints, but it's about 8 dimensional space.
Yes, but this is, as you mentioned, this is a game. And in this game, what we can vary is the probability of different questions. Okay? So what we are interested in is then the probability of winning for any particular question. And there are 4 of them. So, of course, you can distinguish between 0, 0 and 1, 1 here, but since both of them are winning in some game, we just say, we don't bother. And, well, of course, you can make your life more complicated, but it's a question for later.
But isn't it true that this is not necessary and sufficient to reproduce all the quantum, all the quantum probabilities? Only for producing the right correlations or something.
Yes.
There's no finite simple formula.
There are 2 settings and 2 outcomes. It is. You just, instead of this, put some square root of like a complicated thing. But there is no finite formula for any number of settings and any number of outcomes. For 2 settings and for 2 outcomes, there is. This is only for correlations, but there is also one which gives marginal probability distributions. It's actually this Q1 which I mentioned very, very briefly, and it's there's this paper by Navasquez, Pironio, and Asin, a couple of years ago, where they proved it.
Is Q1 equal to Q?
No, of course not.
Didn't prove that?
No, it's not, and it is known. There are known counterexamples.
What do you mean by
Q1 is equal to Q, where Q is the set of quantum probability distributions, only if you consider 2 settings and 2 outcomes.
Did they prove that?
Yes.
I knew that. I thought I knew that paper for that.
Yes?
So I'm trying to understand more clearly the difference between information causality and regular causality is. And so if Alice and Bob shared classical correlations, and Alice sent one bit of information to Bob. Mm-hmm. Bob's probability of guessing whichever of two bits he wants would be at most 75%.
Yes.
Quantum mechanics, he has a probability of 85%. Mm-hmm. And that feels like a violation of our intuitive notion of causality.
Yes, but... mm-hmm.
So you've switched from quantifying, you know, what Bob knows in terms of probabilities to mutual information.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just wondering if there's some sort of deeper significance to that. So, for example, if I reformulated, you know, Bell's notion of local causality in terms of mutual information, mm-hmm. rather than probability, you know, should, if I sort of go further with this idea that, you know, everywhere we've used probability, we've been mistaken, and we should be using mutual information instead, do I get somewhere interesting? Yeah.
No, I don't think so. I mean, I use only mutual information because our principle is about transfer of information, and mutual information is a measure of capacity of the channel. So what I'm saying is that there is this capacity of this channel, and so I measure it. If there is no communication, I don't see a reason to use mutual information there. Mutual information enters here only because this is the measure of channel capacity. This is...
If you're not really in a regime, but you know, you don't have a task, which is defined asymptotically, so I don't really see why channel capacities are relevant here.
I'm
saying, you know, in multiple uses of this channel, what's the amount of information get through?
Well, the trick is like this. So it will be only intuition, but this is my channel. Seen from Bob's perspective, there is information coming, and if Alice wants to put two bits, she can put one bit and two bits here, and the channel is not full. But then I use concatenation, and she can, if she has four bits, it becomes a little more cramped. And eight bits, it's really packed. And in the infinity, she really uses every part of this channel. So from intuitive point of view, this concatenation is sort of like going to this asymptotic number of uses of the channel, but it's like how I see it. I don't have a proof. It's intuition.
I think it's very interesting. Maybe one should switch from a Shannon to a Kornberg. Why don't you to get single uses or a few uses instead of infinitely many concatenations? Is that possible?
Well, I tried. Yes. But I failed, but I didn't exhaust every possibility. So I still believe that what you are saying might work, but I don't know how to make it work. I'm too stupid. Yes?
So you said that hopefully by adding other principles, mm-hmm. imagine that in the future there could be an understanding of quantum mechanics based on information causality. What
yes.
do you feel is possible to get just from information causality? So how much of quantum mechanics in your imagination comes from information causality?
So, as I mentioned, there is this difference that this is necessary for only... this is necessary and sufficient if you consider only this... only correlation function, and this includes marginals. So I guess, and this is also what Lucian mentioned, I don't think you can get any local properties of the systems from information causality, but I think that one might get every non-local possibility. So everything about correlations, and not, yeah.
Let me make the question more precise. Do you think you can get all two outcomes to set things?
Yes. This is my hope. I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, is this the realistic hope, or there is even something more than that?
I think my guess is there will be infinitely many cases where information causality will give you exactly what quantum mechanics does, but there will be still of measure zero in the set of all the cases. This is my guess. It will probably be not true. Yes?
I think I missed something from your talk. So I think at some point you told us that quantum mechanics automatically satisfies information causality.
Yes.
And you had some proof, but I didn't understand what.
So
you listed four things and quantum mechanics automatically satisfies those four things.
Yes, quantum mechanics satisfies those four things, and from these four things, I didn't show.
This chain rule is automatic.
Yes, it is also true in quantum mechanics. So, and from these four things, you can really easily, like two pages, get, and really like simple maths, get information causality.
Is this chain rule the same as what people call entropy subadditivity, or is it?
Strong subadditive, or whatever it's called.
Yeah.
But it's the same thing.
Yes.
Is there any other question? But if not, let's thank Marcin for the very enjoyable talk.